Thanks very much indeed, and thanks for that very rich introduction. However, scholarly integrity requires me to confess that my knowledge of the precise value of sterling on given dates in the 1960s did not arise from a professional pursuit, but because I happened to be a teenager traveling at the time. And I do want to say that much appreciation for your remarks about the foundations of my economic perspective, that one of them is, I'm sure, known to you all, and it's, I'd like to begin these remarks by noting that today is my father's 103rd birthday. Certainly all of us who share the values that we're here to fight for, I think know that he was a formidable ally over a very long period of time. Let me speak first to the value of this meeting, which brings together in Ireland people with a sense of Europe, with a sense of the United States, an understanding of financial history and law, and a critical view of economics in our time, all with a commitment to and a very precise focus on the interests of working people here and elsewhere. It's a very good setting for crystallizing thought, motivating action. The session at which I spoke earlier today was titled "In This Together" with a question mark. For my part, I think the answer to that question is clear. I didn't come here for the purpose simply of comparing notes. I believe we face essentially one problem, one unified crisis, which has been in its acute phase for 4 years now, practically, with sequences of developments that follow one from another, that the crisis has as its cause forces that are transnational in nature, institutions that are international in character, and that is something which can be confronted effectively only by an approach which is at least equally transnational in its understanding, even if it may from time to time be necessary and even effective for the action to arise at the national level. In other words, we're in a fight for life, and we're definitely in it together. I have just been a few days ago in Greece, and I was there longer than I have been here, so I saw a little bit more. And in Athens, you can witness today an entire society, a small but distinguished country, in the middle stages of collapse. You see this very superficially: empty storefronts, the graffiti on the walls, the beggars, the squeegee men, the addicts asleep on the sidewalks, the protests, desperate merchants whose businesses are failing, teachers whose pay has been cut 40%, whose taxes are going up, facing taxes that they can't pay, which would ostensibly support services in health and education, notably, that are also falling apart. In other words, a complex matrix of very rapid social disintegration. And it's all very well to say, as some European leaders have said, that the Greeks have had their fun, referring to good times past, but one has to ask, for a lot of people, what fun? I've never heard of a German or a French civil servant who actually wanted one of those Greek pensions that you hear about. I'm not aware of anyone having applied for one or offered to trade. And one must ask, since when did punishment become an active principle, a guiding principle for policy? On what ground is the idea that passing through punishment will bring economic recovery rest? And perhaps most important, At whom is punishment to be directed? Why in particular are we accepting what is effectively a doctrine of collective guilt and retribution? For that is surely and exactly what is now going on. The apologists for austerity hold that cuts in government services, and as you have heard most recently in the session that we've just listened to, the emphasis is always on cuts in government services. And the shift of the burdens from the rich to the poor on the tax front are a strategy of economic recovery. What is the basis of this belief? It is frequently asserted. It is associated with slogans like crowding out, but very seldom does anyone reflect on it sufficiently to advance an explanation. It rests, I would argue, in part on ideas that have their basis in the political economy of a long time past. The 18th century distinction, which appears prominently in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, between productive and unproductive labor. The idea being that government is a society of retainers, a burden on the private sector, and that the latter will expand while the former shrinks, basically is an automatic process. This was, in fact, had some foundation in fact in the 18th century, at a time when governments basically had two departments, a Department of Army and Navy, which was a department of external looting, and a Department of Taxation, which was a department of internal looting. And in which, of course, people had to function as in what you might loosely call the private sector in order to survive. So I'm not faulting classical political economy except to say that this vision is completely false as a description of the modern world. And the modern world has consisted in turning it from a true to a false proposition. As productivity grows, as the division of labor becomes more profound, as distribution and transport and financial networks, communications are extended, their very survival comes to depend on effective, independent, and trustworthy public presence, especially a regulatory presence and a support for income and the levels of effective demand. Failing that presence, societies will decay and go back from being advanced to being backward. In the absence of those regulations and effective public presence, and you can find this all through the world today, people are forced to take steps to protect themselves from the depredations of market forces, which absorb an enormous amount of their time, sap their energy, their health, and shorten their lives. Whether this is protecting their food supply, protecting themselves from the dangers of equipment that they're asked to use, experiencing congestion and delays in going about their daily business, life is just much harder when there isn't an effective balance between the public and private sector, and it's harder and it's also shorter. The problem of the financial sector at the origin of the present crisis, especially in the United States, but I would argue certainly also in different ways in Europe, lies precisely with the failures of formerly trustworthy regulation and supervision. Failures which were in many cases quite deliberate. That is to say, they facilitated an illusion of growth in a period when growth would otherwise have been very difficult to have. They were exactly of the form of the bad growth that was mentioned a few minutes ago. In the United States, after the end of the dot-com boom, growth was largely maintained, or the illusion of growth was maintained, by extending mortgage financing to people and communities who, on terms which they were known it was known they would not be able to pay, a very temporary matter which was certain to lead to the disaster that followed, and which entailed a vast amount of financial fraud, a vast amount of criminal activity, because if you are extending loans that are going to fail, you have to find someone to buy them. And in general, you cannot get an independent investor to buy a loan which is going to entail a massive loss unless you misrepresent the terms of that sale. That's an elementary commercial proposition. The claim now that reducing the public presence, generally in the economy, but especially through privatization, is closely related to the idea that the state should no longer have this regulatory presence in sector after sector, that this should be run as the financial sector was run in the 2000s on a de-supervised basis. The thought that this will fix anything is plainly and absolutely false. There is no path to good governance or prosperous economics by replacing bad or weak states with no states at all. It is a pathway to collapse, as sure as anything is. A second argument for austerity relates to projections. It's a financial argument. It relates to projections of deficits and interest rates, with the idea being that it's credit markets who are like stern but forgiving parents and who will welcome the prodigals home when they have repented and reformed. This is a story with a certain resonance for with an older tradition of moral instruction, and it's known in the profession as the confidence fairy argument. The idea that once you have demonstrated that you are truly a different person, that the sources of finance, whatever they are, but they are deeply anonymized in this little tale, will bestow upon you the favor of their approval in the form of low interest rates and favorable terms, and everything will come out fine. And for this reason, you need to go through a period of discipline and character building. It is, I think, something which is an argument that has a certain appeal to finance ministers who like to believe that the buttons they push are actually connected to the elevator that they happen to be on. But it should be obvious why it fails. Among many reasons, I would suggest that the key one is that investors are not that interested in what debtors do. They are interested in what other investors are doing, right? And that is the community to which they respond. They are not even in a position to evaluate in an objective way what the debtors are up to. What they do in a boom, when the other investors are enthusiastic, they lend to the weak credits, overlooking the defects on their balance sheets and in their business plans. Did something like this happen in Ireland in recent years? It might argue that it did. Did it happen in Greece? Did it happen in Spain? Did it happen in the United States? It seems to me that is the plausible explanation. And at the same time, they all withdraw simultaneously in the panic. After that event, the fate of all of the weak credits is linked. And a run on Greece or some adverse event anywhere is going to cause them to sell Ireland, not necessarily because of the particular policies being pursued here. They might like them or not like them if they ever looked, but because they know that's what the other investors are going to do. The line of travel, in other words, is not from bad to good, but from small to big, and from weak to strong, from risky to secure. And that explains why, despite all efforts to sow doubt in U.S. financial markets, with the scary forecasts and even the big drama over the debt ceiling and the possibility that, my God, the U.S. Treasury might default on bonds last summer, the long-term interest rate never started to rise. In fact, it continued to fall because as a general climate of instability If there was any effect on financial markets in a general climate of instability, investors were always going to regard the very large and liquid U.S. Treasury market as more secure than anybody else's, and they were always going to sell the other stuff to buy into that. This is one of the most important ways, in fact, that we are in this crisis together, and we have to recognize that we're in it in a way which is not necessarily symmetric. Well, government spending, this point is often forgotten, but according to the national income accounts that I'm familiar with and that I believe were developed and adopted fairly widely in the post-war period, government spending is actually a part of the gross domestic product. G is an element of GDP. And so the actual consequences of austerity were easily foreseen and are now plainly visible. Declining output, rising unemployment, bigger deficits, growing debt. That is what was on offer, and that was the only thing on the menu. And when the consequences become plain, the consequences of eating at this particular bar, what do they say? They say that austerity has not gone far enough. That more is needed to meet a particular ex-ante target with, again, as was mentioned a few minutes ago, an assumption that the economic growth will be there to support the debt-to-GDP ratio. This is the language, and more importantly, it is the process of thought of the fanatic. It brings to mind, one can speak of religious fundamentalism, but cleaner metaphor is that of the medieval medicine man who's draining blood into a pan as the patient turns white. And as the recovery fails to advance, opens another line to let some more of the noxious liquid out. And one thinks of the line attributed to Einstein. I don't know if he actually said this or not, but if he didn't, he should have. That insanity consists in always doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Now, this is all, everything I've said about austerity, about the false premises and the easily foreseeable results, is actually true, plainly true, and it is best to assume that it is known that our leaders, who are not foolish people for the most part, have their own reasons for advancing a line of argument that they must know to be false. And of course, they do have such reasons. In part, they are told that there is no alternative by international powers, who in turn have subordinated every other objective to the process of denial, to avoiding recognition of the actual financial state of the banks. There are people who wish to work for banks someday who especially feel this way. And we'll be very disappointed if those institutions are not there to pay executive salaries at rates similar to those currently being earned. And in part also, to be fair, political leaders are caught by their coalition partners and by their constituents, who may hold a Victorian vice virtue view of debt, even if the leaders themselves do not. However, in the end, all downward spirals of this kind, debt deflations, in which the numerator rises while the denominator falls, debt to GDP, all of these end in roughly the same way: restructuring, deep haircuts, outright default, followed by post-default negotiations, or not, perhaps by following a period of crisis, a change in the basis of the financing of economic growth. And it's plain that the Greek tragedy is moving down that path, and at this stage moving down it quite rapidly. The Greek government will not choose default. It will be forced on them when the Germans and the French decide to stop the recycling of funds to Greece. And that brings us to the particular severity as I was describing a minute ago, of the punishment that is today being inflicted on Greece. What's it for? Obviously, and as Yanis Varoufakis has written recently, it's to discourage the others from seeking and asking for the same deal, for the same debt relief that Greece inevitably will eventually receive. The punishment, in short, is not, in fact, gratuitous. It's not theological entirely, and it's not also not entirely for the internal political reasons, purposes of Germany and France. It is rather to make an impression on the Spaniards, the Portuguese, the Irish, and I suppose especially the Italians. And once you realize that that is in fact what is going on, if you find that to be a persuasive description of the motivation, and it seems to me to be something that meets the test of, let's say, cold-eyed rationality, then you have to ask, how can any decent and moral person be a party to it? How can this possibly be acceptable to anyone who sees it for what it is? And of course it will not work, for the logic supposes that Greece is a special case and that you could make, say, the Latvian solution work everywhere else. That this is the position that's coming from, example, the European Central Bank is made plain by the remarkable pressure from the Troika against private sector wage bargains, minimum wages, whose relationship to the fiscal posture of the government seems to be at least a little bit remote. And particularly if you saw it by the most remarkable letter from Monsieur Trichet and Mr. Draghi to the Italian government on the urgent need for radical privatization of local services in Italy. Such matters take one very far away from the actual competence or supposed competence of central bankers, if in fact they have actual competence, which is a proposition that we could discuss later. In fact, there may well be cases where internal deflation, if sufficiently severe and rapid and accompanied by favorable external conditions, can result in a return to growth. So it's quite possible that the Latvians can recover from where they are. But that is a case which is much more likely to be true for a small country in a favorable environment, and practically certain not to be true for any substantial country that has to grow from the basis of its internal development. It will not be a general rule. So the ship continues toward the iceberg. For the moment, I see no chance that any debtor government will act to save itself. They are all weak, vulnerable, cowed, perhaps to some extent under the influence of the Stockholm syndrome, or simply macabre-ish, hoping for a stroke of luck or a benevolent rescue, which unfortunately will not come. I don't see the technical solution, which I admire greatly, the Varoufakis Holland proposal, the modest proposal, advancing quickly enough at this stage, although it is always possible, and we could hope that a change of governments might possibly change the climate and put it over, and that is certainly something for which one might begin to work. So the initiative, therefore, lies with Berlin and Paris, who appear to be planning a Greece-only default combined with the asset-stripping plan known as the Eureka Plan. And if you don't know about this, I strongly recommend you look into it, which has been advanced in quasi-public as a private sector idea, but has been described to me by high authority as effectively the official semi-secret plan to dismantle Greece entirely in the wake of the financial restructuring. And if that goes into effect, then some time may pass before the next country goes through the same process. And I needn't tell you who the candidates might be. for that. Down this path, if that's the way things go, popular resistance will be spread out through time and therefore substantially less effective. Right? Much more likely to be repressible on a case-by-case basis. So what's the alternative? Again, with due deference to the fact that it is possible to build a technically viable workout of this problem at the level of Europe, we have to admit the possibility that the politics are not going to come together for that. And the alternative remains to organize a common resistance and to do so now, to say no, to acknowledge that the system has failed, not just in technical respects, but in a massive institutional way, not just in the insufficiency of aggregate demand, but in the capacity of the enterprises that were vested with the authority of directing economic development to do so, and that the wreckage needs to be cleared away and reconstruction started on a fundamentally different basis, and one that does, in fact, address the problems that we all have and that we share in common, the problems of energy and climate change, the problems of infrastructure, the problems of education, the problems of caring for an elderly population. In other words, the problems that we are not talking about because we are so deeply preoccupied with working our way through these financial issues. And the system that has failed, in this case, in Europe, as also in the United States, is plainly the banking system, something which is being recognized in popular actions that are beginning to come together as we meet. Certainly in New York, we have seen a rather creative and imaginative group of people, including, I have to say with great pride, my daughter, occupying Wall Street, and the city of New York backed off of their plan to clear them out over the next day or so. In Greece on the 6th of October, in fact, I had to leave a day early because the civil servants of the Hellenic Republic decided that the air traffic would not be available to me on the date of my planned departure. And the same thing happened to me in France on October 11th when I needed to get to Geneva. And the train workers were in a mood to that I should move by a different method of transportation. So we are seeing the beginnings of a popular consciousness that is motivated by the same frustrations, I think, that gave rise to the Tea Party movement in the United States a year ago, but is focused, in fact, on the actual problem, on the actual obstacle to creating an effective change in economic conditions. And that tells us, I think, that in the final analysis, the resolution of the crisis does lie in building a world, a more democratic world, in which bankers and banks are elevated to the useful role of functionaries and engineers rather than overlords and privateers. The half-hidden government of a predator state. Thanks very much.